Montcalm. The overseer had arrived at the open gate in the crenellated wall before the master's house. Half turned toward it, he looked back over his shoulder at the group of strangers and the wares exposed for sale. "What is this?" he said rather gruffly. "What men are these?" It seemed as though he had forgotten, in the press of other affairs, that he had sent for them to come in. Nor did the exhaustive salutations of the old man help matters much. A scribe reminded him, pointing to his tablet, upon which he had obviously noted the incident. "Yes, yes, the peddlers from Ma'on or Mosar," said the overseer then. "Good, good, but I need nothing except time, and that they have not for sale." And he approached the old man, who came bustling up to him. "Well, old man, how are you after all this time?" asked Montcalm. "So we see you at our door with your goods, all ready to swindle us once more?" They laughed together. Both of them had only the lower canines left in their jaws, sticking up solitary like posts. The steward was a stocky, powerfully built man of 50, with an expressive head. The decided bearing which his office brought with it was softened by benevolence. He had very prominent tear ducts under his eyes, giving the latter a swollen, slit-like look beneath heavy, still-black eyebrows. From the well-formed, though wide-nostrilled nose, deep furrows ran down to the corners of the arched and outstanding upper lip, which, like the cheeks, was shaven so that it shone. On the chin sat a club-shaped beard, sprinkled with gray. The hair had already retreated from brow and temples, but grew in a bush at the back of the head, standing out like a fan behind the ears, in which he wore gold rings. Montcalm's features had something traditionally shrewd and peasant-like about them, and withal a twinkle that suggested the seafaring man. His dark red-brown complexion contrasted with the florid white of his clothing, that inimitable Egyptian linen which lent itself to such exquisite folds and pleating as those in the front flap of his apron kilt, the stiffly starched flaring folds of which began below his navel and reached down nearly to the ankle-length hem. His body garment was tucked into the apron, and its wide, half-length sleeves were likewise pressed into fine, diagonal folds. The fine batiste revealed his muscular, hairy torso. The two dwarfs had taken leave to remain in the court, and Dudu now came up to Montcalm, paddling importantly and rowing with his stumpy arms. "I fear, overseer, it is time lost to deal with these people," he said, and notwithstanding his stature, he spoke as an equal. "I have looked over their stock. I see trumpery. I see gimcrackery. What lacks is good, solid, high-class stuff, suitable for an aristocratic house and estate. The master will scarcely be grateful to you for purchasing trash." The old man was cast down. He indicated by a gesture his distress that the overseer's hopeful and cordial greetings should have aroused in him expectations which now were destroyed by Dudu's severity. "But I have valuable goods, too," he said. "Maybe not valuable to you upper officials, nor, of course, to your lord. I have not said that. But how many servants are there not in the courtyard? Cooks and bakers, gardeners and water-bearers, runners and waiters-on. Countless like the sands of the sea. Yet not so many that they are enough, or too many for such a great lord as Petipre, his grace, the friend of Pharaoh. Or that one could not always add one or another well-built and clever slave, let him be native or a foreigner, if only he be useful. But why do I prattle of what is not to the point, instead of saying simply, 'You, great steward, buy for the many and their use. You stand as their head.' And it is the business of the old Menean, the travelling peddler with his popular wares, to suggest to you, 'Look at these well-painted earthenware lamps from Gilead beyond the Jordan. They cost me little, so should I value them high to you, my patron? Take some of them as a present, and if I may see your favor, therefore, I am rich. On the other hand, these little pots of eye-paint with cowhorn tweezers and spoons of cowhorn, their value is considerable, but not their price. Here are hoes, an indispensable tool. I will give one for two pots of honey. More costly indeed are the contents of this little bag, for there are onions from Ascalon in it, from Ascaluna, rare and hard to come by as they are savory. But the wine in these jugs is 8 times good wine from Hadati in the land of Phoenicia, as it stands written. Lo, I grade my offers. I go from the lower to the higher, and from them to the very choice. That is my considered practice. For the balsams here, and incense resins, the goat's thorn gums, the brownish labdanum, they are the pride of my business, and the specialty of my house. We would be praised and renowned between the rivers, because we are stronger in sudorifics than any merchant, be he travelling trader or a settled man of the bazaar. There are the Ishmaelites from Midian, they say of us. They carry spices, balsam, and myrrh from Gilead down toward Egypt. So is it in the mouth of the people, precisely as though we did not carry and bring much else, as doth in truth happen, dead and alive, the created or the creature, so that we are the men not only to provide a house, but also to increase it. But I am silent. What? You are silent? The overseer pretended amaze. Do you ail, then? For when you are silent, I know you not, but only when your mild prattle of speech wells out from under your beard. I can still hear it from the last time, and know you by it again. Is not, responded the old man, speech the pride of mankind? Who knows how to set his words well, and hath a gift of expression? Upon him gods and men nod with applause, and he findeth inclined ears. But your servant is little gifted with expression, and not master of the treasure of speech. I say it openly. So then he must substitute persistency for speech, and duration of flow for what it lacks in choiceness. For the merchant must be of ready tongue, the which must know how to flatter his clients, or he cannot earn his living, and doth not bring the 7 gifts to the man. 6, came the whispering of little Bess, as from afar off, although he stood quite near. 6 gifts, old man, you offered. Lamps, salve, hose, onions, wine, and myrrh. Where is the 7th? The Ishmaelite laid his left hand like a mussel shell round his ear, and the right to his eyes to peer. What, he asked, was the remark of this middle-sized, gaily-clad gentleman? One of his party repeated it to him. Oh, he replied, the 7th likewise is to be found among all the things which we have brought down to Egypt, besides the much-talked-of myrrh. For it, too, will I let my tongue run on, with persistency, if not with chosen words, that I may bring the ware to the man and the house, and that the Ishmaelites of Midian may make for themselves a name on account of all that which they bear and bring to Egypt. Spare me, said the overseer. Do you think I can stand here and hear you chatter all the days of Re? He is already almost at his midday. May the gods keep us. Any minute the master may come home from the west and be here again from the palace. Shall I then leave it to the slaves and trouble not myself whether all is right in the dining room, with the roast ducks, the cakes, the flowers, and the master find his meal as he is used to, likewise the mistress and the exalted parents from the upper story? Make haste, or else make off. I must go. Old man, I cannot well use you or your 7 gifts, scarcely at all, to be frank. For they are but beggarly trash, interpolated Dudu, the married dwarf. The overseer gave a downward glance as he heard the harsh judgment. But you have need of honey, it seems, he said to the old man. I will give you a few pots against 2 of these hoes, that I may not offend you or your gods. Give me 5 bags of the little onions, too, in the name of the hidden one, and 5 measures of your Phoenician wine, in the name of the mother and the son. Tell me the cost, yet give me not first the triple price, as a haggler does, so that we sit down and bargain, but at most the double one, so that we may come more quickly to the just one, and I can go in. I will give you writing paper in exchange, and some of our linen. If you like, beer and bread as well. Only make haste that I may go." "You are served," said the old man, loosing the hand-scale from his girdle. "You are served in a trice, and without conditions served by your servant." "What am I saying, without conditions?" "With conditions, of course, but only of the best. Had I not to live, the things were yours without price. But even so, I will make you a price that may indeed cut me short, yet keep myself in your favor, for that is my chief concern." "Hallo," said he to Joseph over his shoulder, "take the list of wares which you have made, the things in black, but the weight and quantity in red. Take and read to us the weight of the shallots as well as the wine, that is, their price, but translate, as you stand and in your head, into the values of the country, in debon and lot, that we may know what the goods are worth in pounds of copper, and the high steward may give us, for just so much copper, linen and writing paper of the house. But I, my patron, if you will allow, will weigh out the goods once more for test and proof." Joseph had the roll ready, and stepped forward as he unrolled it. Next him stood Master Bess, who indeed was far from being able to look at the list, but gazed up attentively at the extended hands. "Doth my lord command me to read the just price, or the double one?" asked Joseph discreetly.
"The just one, of course. Dost thou dote?" the old man scolded.
"But the high steward commanded that thou shouldst name the double price," responded Joseph with the most charming seriousness. "If now I name the just one, he might take it for the double, and offer but the half. And how then couldst thou live? Better would it be if he took the double price for the real one, and if he drive it down, even so thou comest not short."
"He, he, he,"
the old man laughed.
"He, he,"
he went again, and looked at the overseer to see how he took it. The scribes, with the reed pens behind their ears, laughed. The thumbling beauty clapped his knee with his little hand, drawing it up to his chest and hopping on the other. His goblin face was flawed into a thousand little wrinkles of dwarfish delight. But Dudu, his brother mannequin, only shook his head and stuck out the thatch of his upper lip more disdainfully than ever. As for Montcalm, he had so far, of course, given no heed to the knowing young scribe with the roll, but now he looked at him with a surprise which at once turned to perplexity, and presently to something very like admiration, save that it betokened indeed a far, far deeper feeling. Perhaps, I will not venture an assertion, perhaps, at this moment, upon which so much depended, the planning God of his fathers did a little something extra for Joseph. Perhaps he let fall upon him a light calculated to produce the desired effect upon the hearts of all beholders. For he, in truth, has given us all our senses for our pleasure, yet reserved to himself their use as medium and avenue for his larger purposes to play upon our minds. Hence my suggestion, which, however, I am willing to withdraw if it seemed too supernatural an element to be introduced into our very natural tale. Indeed, the more natural and practical our interpretations, the better, since Montcalm himself was a practical and natural man. Besides, he belonged to a world already remote from any in which the idea of meeting a god unexpectedly, in broad daylight, and, so to speak, on the street, would have been a familiar thing. Yet even so, his world stood nearer than ours does to such possibilities and expectations, though in his they might only have been held with half one's mind, no longer in a real, positive, and unequivocal sense. It came to pass that Montcalm looked at Rachel's son and saw that he was beautiful. But beauty of so striking and arresting a kind was associated in the steward's mind with one immediate order of ideas. It belonged to the moon, which was the planet of Jehuti, of Khmunu. Tote's heavenly manifestation. Tote, who was master of measure and order, the wise man, scribe, and magician. And now Joseph stood there before him, a roll in his hands, and in his mouth words which for a slave, even an educated one, were unusually subtle and shrewd. The combination was upsetting. The young Bedouin and Asiatic had no ibis head on his shoulders. He was, of course, a human being, not a god, not Tot of Khmunu. But he had, by association, to do with him. He seemed ambiguous, in the way that a word can be ambiguous. For instance, the epithet divine. Compared with the august substantive from which it derives, it conveys indeed a weakening, a derogation of the idea. It is not absolute, but only suggestive, and thus it is partly unreal and derivative, but partly, too, lays claim to absoluteness in that the word divine is a description of the perceptible attributes and form of the god. Some such equivocal associations came to Montcalm's mind and gave him pause when he saw Joseph for the first time. It was indeed a recurrent event. Others before him had felt the same. Still others would yet feel it. But we must not suppose that Montcalm was very powerfully moved. He felt no more than what we might express by the exclamation, "What the devil?" He did not say that. He asked, "What is that?" He cautiously, likewise somewhat contemptuously, said, "What?" instead of "Who?" And thus the old man's answer came very pat. "That," he replied with a smirk, "is the seventh gift."